Hi, everybody, and welcome to our CLE for April, Medicaid Qualification Considerations for Retirement Accounts and Deferred Annuities. That is a really long title and a mouthful, and Mark Munson will be presenting with me here today. But before we get started, I do want to just go through a couple housekeeping items. The first, introducing Kraus Financial, for those of you that don't know who we are. We are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we use specialized insurance products, resources, and support, and we help attorneys streamline the process of advising clients planning for long-term care. And obviously, our topic here today is going to be around some of those assets that most people have here in 2025 that they've used for their retirement savings. We've been in business for a while. We have a great group of staff to help, and we handle a good number of cases each and every month. We will hold questions until the end, so please feel free to put your questions into that question box in the GoToWebinar control panel there on the right-hand side of your screen. The PowerPoint, it has been converted into a PDF, and that's in the handout section of those menus, so if you want to print that out and take notes on it like I like to do, you can do that out of the handout section. And then for the CLE credits, there will be a survey that will pop up at the end of the seminar and then also will be included in the post webinar email that will go out to all of those of you that have registered for the webinar. So either wait till the end of the webinar, or if you need to leave a little bit early, we will have that email that will go out with the survey. But that survey will be kind of your ticket to get that CLE certificate. So with that housekeeping done, Mark, do you want to introduce yourself to the audience here, and then we'll kick off and get started with the content?
Sure. Thanks, Jim, and thank you to Kraus Financial Services for having me. Always look forward to doing these webinars. I've been practicing estate planning and elder law a long time, over 25 years, and looking forward to the webinar today. Thanks again for having me, and thanks again for attending.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much. Mark has been lecturing on these topics across the country, and I've seen him multiple times, and he always does a great job of taking these very complicated type assets and really breaking down the different elements of them. But before we get into that side of things, I want to cover very quickly and set the stage for Mark of why these assets are so important when it comes to advising clients on Medicaid qualification. So to do that, I'm going to run through some qualification concepts, again, very quickly. And if this is your first time being exposed to these, don't worry if we kind of lose you along the way. We have lots and lots of resources on our attorney access platform for some of these foundational concepts that I'll go through again at a pretty quick pace because I want to give Mark as much time as possible. So the Medicaid program that we're talking about is a joint federal and state program that covers certain health-related costs for individuals with limited income and resources. And what we're going to talk about today is in the context of long-term care. So what we'll be talking about is qualifying for assistance with paying for the medical services that people receive in a nursing home. And so that's really the focus of the Medicaid program that we'll be talking about. And one thing that's really important to think about is because Medicaid is a joint and state program, each state has the ability to make its own unique regulations. And they can basically, the way I like to think about this, is play within the sandbox whose borders are outlined by the federal rules, and then the state can make their own rules within there. And that's going to come into play with how these assets are accountable resources, and we'll get to that momentarily. But the important part is in order to qualify, applicants have to meet both financial and non-financial criteria. And the financial criteria is really where the complicated rules come into play. But I do want to just make sure that we do hit on the non-financial criteria as well. They're pretty straightforward. Basically, to qualify for Medicaid, an applicant has to be a U.S. citizen or qualified non-citizen, be age 65 or older, blind or disabled, and reside in a Medicaid-approved facility and need nursing home level of care. So those are kind of the non-financial requirements. And again, we have lots of resources on covering all of these requirements on our platform. But the financial requirements is really where we're going to spend our time here today. And we're even going to zoom in closer to specific retirement accounts and resources within these financial requirements. But the way to think of financial requirements in Medicaid qualification, the easiest way for me to think about this is to divide those financial requirements into two different categories, one for income and one for assets. And there's specific rules and considerations for each category. And generally, except for the assets we're going to talk about today, that rule holds pretty clear. Is something's either an asset or it's considered income. However, the complex assets that we'll be talking about today deal with kind of both sides of the equation. So I want to make sure that we lay the foundation of why are we worried about assets. And one of the key concepts to understand is when someone is going to qualify for nursing home Medicaid assistance is they have to have very low assets. My former co-presenter at Valerie Peterson, she coined the term that the client has to be sick and broke. And the reason why she says that is because the finances of the person applying to receive Medicaid benefits have to be below what's called an individual resource allowance. And in most states, the individual is allowed to keep $2,000. But you can see there's some exceptions to that. California, if you're on this call and you're from California, you can just turn it off because they have no asset requirements and they're just kind of living in the Wild West right now. They're not sure how long it's going to last, but as of today, California doesn't have an asset limit, so you don't have to worry about these accounts or whether or not they're countable or not countable or what to do with them. But the rest of the country does, and you can see if it's not $2,000, I put the exceptions there, but it's usually not a lot of money. So that's kind of where the broke side comes from. And then if you're married, there's another resource allowance that the community spouse can keep, and that's called the community spouse resource allowance. You also hear us probably refer to this throughout the presentation as the CISRA or the community spouse resource allowance. And that again is a limitation on what the couple can keep together and still qualify for Medicaid. There's two ways that states have broken this requirement down. Some states have a minimum and a maximum. And if you're in a minimum and a maximum state, those numbers are between $31,000 and $157,000. And basically, the community spouse is entitled to one half of the couple's total countable assets, so long as it falls between that range. Other states will just have one number. If you're in one of those states, that's great. It makes things a lot simpler, where it's just the number. And in most states, that's generally $157,920 in most states. So the concept here to walk away from is we have an individual resource allowance. It's pretty low. Most states, it's $2,000. If the applicant is married, there's also community spouse resource allowance that the maximum that the couple will be allowed to keep is at $157,920. Combine those two, we're usually looking at around $160,000 total that a couple could keep. And an individual, if they're not married again, is around $2,000. So that's a very limited amount of money that the couple can keep. So if the applicant has resources above those numbers, they won't be able to qualify for Medicaid benefits. So then we have to turn and think about, okay, what is a countable asset? Oh, here's a map to tell you kind of what state you're in. If you're in one of those green states, then it's a minimum maximum. If you're in a gray state, it's just the one number just for your resources there. And you can find all your numbers on Attorney Access as well. So when we're thinking about, okay, we have these limitations. So what's a countable and non-countable asset? And this is where we're really going to get into and segueing into these accounts that we're going to talk about today. If you look at the right side of this slide, the countable assets generally are assets. And the easiest way to think about this, and when I was learning it, it really simplified things for me, is if the applicant can get to those assets, convert those assets to cash, and then pay for their own care, that's pretty much going to be a countable asset unless it's specifically excluded. So that's pretty much everything that the client owns. So we have countable assets, things that you would think of, checking, savings, brokerage accounts, stocks, bonds. And then we get into these kind of complex assets, deferred annuities, retirement accounts, any additional property, things that aren't necessarily really easy to access and turn into cash. And that's why these assets can cause attorneys the biggest headache. And that's why we like to talk about them at least once a year. And we're talking to Mark about that. And that's probably not enough times because they are so complicated. And then we have our exempt assets on the left side. The most important one is a primary residence, one vehicle, personal property, life insurance, funeral expense trust. And we have webinars that go on hours and hours on all of these assets. But the ones we're really going to focus on are those deferred annuities and those retirement accounts on the countable asset side. Now, you can see on that right side, it says retirement accounts unless specifically exempted by the state Medicaid agency. So what some states have done is said, we're not going to count those IRAs. We're not going to count those retirement accounts. And basically, they have specifically said that. But the way to think about this rule is they're going to be countable unless my state has specifically excluded them. And you can see on a map here of how the states have handled this. So I'm going to try to move this menu so I can take a look at it. Hopefully it doesn't ruin everything. Do you still see my screen there, Mark?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah. Sometimes when I touch things, things get all out of whack. So this map shows that if you look down at the, let's start with the orange states. In those states, the IRAs of both spouses are countable. So if you're in an orange state, and this map is a little bit out of date because Indiana just changed their rules. So if you're in Indiana, consider yourself an orange state, unfortunately, where the IRAs of both spouses are countable. So if the applicant has an IRA, that's going to be a countable asset. If the community spouse has an IRA, that too will be countable. If you're in a gray state, minus Indiana, which is now orange, the IRAs of the community spouse are exempt. So if the applicant is married and the community spouse has an IRA, that's an exempt asset. It doesn't count towards that community spouse resource allowance. If you're in a black state, thank goodness you can log off this call probably because the IRAs of both spouses are exempt. So those are non-countable assets within those states. And there's an asterisk there. Because the IRA has to be, the IRA owner has to be taking the required minimum distributions from that to be an exempt asset. So hopefully you're in one of those black states. The IRAs are off the table. They're not going to count towards some of those allowances. However, for the majority of us, either the IRA for the institutionalized spouse is going to be a countable asset, or the IRA of both spouses are going to be countable assets. So we have to deal with these assets when we're advising our clients on Medicaid qualification. And that's why these assets can become so important when we're advising clients on what can we do to accelerate Medicaid eligibility when we have some of these assets on the table that, again, most Americans are now using to fund their retirement. So that's kind of the asset side. Set the table. We have to deal with them because they're countable assets and they could push our clients above those resource limitations. Now, on the other side of the equation, these assets that people have, the IRAs and these deferred annuities, are kicking out income. And so we have to think about how does that income impact my client's Medicaid qualification. Now, for qualification purposes, kind of the broad rule is that the institutionalized person's income from all earned and unearned sources has to be less than the private pay rate in a facility. The average pay rate of a private nursing home facility in the United States is $10,000. Generally, this isn't a problem. Our client's income usually doesn't get up to $10,000, but this income does include pension, Social Security, and distribution from these retirement accounts. So we have to make sure that the income amount that they're getting each month stays below the private pay rate of the facility. Now, the kicker is when someone does apply and is qualified to receive nursing home benefits, once they're approved, their income is going to become their copay. So that income that's coming in is going to end up going to the nursing home where they're staying as their Medicaid copay. So now if you think about the reasons why most people set up a retirement account is to have some money grow tax deferred, and Mark's going to talk about how these accounts work, but that income is to sustain their lifestyle and just to make sure they didn't run out of money during their retirement. And is there an option to turn off that income that's coming in from these specialized accounts so it's not going to the nursing home? And we're going to talk about that because generally all that money is going to end up at the nursing home minus a few deductions like personal needs allowance, which isn't a whole lot of money, insurance premiums, or an income shift if the person's married and has qualify through the MMNA rules. But for the most part, just remember that rule that if someone qualifies for Medicaid, their income is going to go to that nursing home under the rules. So those are the reasons why these accounts really come into play on probably, I would say, the majority of your Medicaid planning cases, because this is where folks are paying for retirement. So with that set up, Mark, I'm going to hand this over to you, where you can teach us about these accounts, their tax, the way that they're taxed, the way that they function, the way they pay out income, and then what the liquidation options are if somebody's looking to qualify for Medicaid.
Sounds good. So, you know, we're mainly going to focus today on talking about IRAs, because in the context of elder law and people who are 65 and older, retired, and no longer working, generally the IRA, you know, comes from a retirement plan. You know, that retirement plan's probably a 401k, or it may be a 403b, and we'll kind of, I think a couple slides we'll get into that, and you do these things that are called tax-free rollovers, so that when you retire, you no longer have to be tied to your former employer's retirement plan, and you can kind of do your own individual retirement plan in your own individual retirement account, which is what the IRA is all about. So if you think about, you know, working, and as you're working, you're taking your income and you're putting some of that income into the retirement plan. Let's just use a 401k. The income that's going into that 401k is pre-tax income, meaning it's never been subject to income tax yet. And so that helps keep your income lower while you're working. And what is also happening is that, you know, presumably what goes into that retirement account is being put to work for you. It's being invested. And if it's invested, we have all these, you know, sorts of terms of interest. Maybe it's interest on some bonds. Maybe the another term is dividends, and it could be dividends on stocks or mutual funds. And then another term is capital gain. If you've made a lot of money and you sell, you have some capital gain. All of that is income for income tax purposes, but if that income occurs inside of a retirement account, a 401k, or even a traditional IRA, that's not subject to immediate income taxation. And so this is the concept of deferral. So what's going into the account is pre-tax income. It's not subject to income tax when it goes in. That keeps your current taxes lower. And all the earnings, the growth, and everything that's happening inside of that retirement account, all of that income is also deferred. So I've kind of used the term, it's not probably politically correct, but I've used the term in describing these deferred retirement accounts, deferred income retirement accounts, as loaded guns, because they're dangerous when we start messing around with them as planners. And clients generally, I think, are okay with taxes if they know about it. What clients don't like are surprises, and that's why it's helpful to spend some time talking about these accounts and how they work, so that you can properly advise clients about the income tax consequences. What makes these accounts, you know, dangerous is that if you don't know what you're doing, your client can owe a fairly big tax bill, and they're not going to like that. if they don't know that it's coming. And so, you know, if you want the politically correct way of talking about these accounts, you just say, well, IRAs are special accounts. Why are they special accounts? Because there's special income tax rules that surround them. And so, you know, the traditional retirement account is we're going to put, you know, what that is all about is we're putting pre-tax income into the account. So it's not that that contribution has never been subject to income tax yet. All the earnings are going to grow tax-free. But when you take money out of the traditional IRA, that is income for income tax purposes. And it's ordinary income, not capital gain income. It's just ordinary income. Ordinary income is like earned income. You've earned it, and you pay ordinary income taxes. When money comes out of a traditional retirement account, that is ordinary income for income tax purposes. And the code section for these is 408. So a Roth retirement account is a little bit different, because what's different about it is that the retirement, the contribution, what goes into that account is post-tax money. It's money that has already been subject to income tax, and you are putting post-tax money in as the contribution. Once again, the earnings grow income tax-free. So the interest, the dividends, the capital gains, all that is growing income tax-free inside of the Roth retirement account. The big difference with the Roth retirement account is that as long as you follow the rules, and there's certain rules, you have to have it in there for 5 years or 59 and a half. You got to be older than that. But when you pull the money out, it is not income for income tax purposes. It's just, you just get it. And so that's a big benefit of the Roth, is that what goes in is after tax money, but what comes out is not taxable at all. It is not income for income tax purposes. So that's the big benefit. And, you know, if you're talking with Krauss Financial Services and coming up with a plan, and somebody has a Roth retirement account, you know, the tax consequences there presumably are not going to be too bad when you have to deal with that and get down to a certain asset level. So continuing on the theme of types of retirement accounts, we've kind of already talked about these, but 401k plans and 403 plans are employer-sponsored plans. And many, many employers are, you know, have these plans. And it's a benefit, and it's how employers compete in the marketplace for employees. And the better the plan, the more, you know, presumably the more qualified and more talented candidate they're going to get. If everything is equal, but one 401k plan offers, you know, more employer contributions than the other one, you're probably going to go with that employer. So 401k plans are generally for private employers. 403 plans are generally for public employers. So we'll go to the next slide. So we've kind of touched on this already, but non-Roth retirement accounts, you know, your standard 401k plan, your standard 403 plan, and your traditional IRA, money that goes in is pre-income tax. It's never been subject to income taxation before. As long as it stays inside the account, the 401k, the 403b, or the traditional IRA, the earnings are going to grow income tax-free. And then when the money comes out to the client in retirement, that is ordinary income for income tax purposes. Just as earnings from a salary would be ordinary income. It's the same treatment there. So with Roth retirement accounts, what you're putting in is after-tax money or post-income tax money. It's already been subject to income tax. Once it's in there, it's the earnings are still going to grow income tax-free. But again, as long as you follow the general rules, when you take money out, that is not income for income tax purposes. So that's the advantage of the Roth. So while this is where we get into some really, really more complicated stuff. But it matters for Medicaid. If you go back, I'm not going to ask Jim to go back a couple slides, but if you remember the slide you saw a couple slides back, and it talked about, required minimum distributions. And if you're in required minimum distribution mode, then these assets might be exempt for purposes of Medicaid eligibility. One consideration I will, throw out there, just so that you're thinking about the big picture as an advisor is, just because in an account is perhaps exempt on the eligibility side does not mean it's necessarily exempt on the estate recovery side. So these are things that, we have to be thinking about is that, okay, great, this account isn't going to cause me a problem for going on Medicaid. But once you go on Medicaid, the state's keeping track of what dollars it has paid on your behalf, and it's going to look to recover that money down the road. So if you still have retirement accounts in your name because they're an exempt asset, that's something to be mindful of, because what does the client ultimately after, and what are their children expecting? Even though they might not be your client, they're always thinking and expecting. So just because something is exempt on the eligibility side does not mean it's exempt on the estate recovery side when your client passes. So just something to remember and keep in mind as you're working with clients. So the distribution requirements, again, non-Roth retirement accounts, you had pre-tax money go in, and at some point during your lifetime, the government has rules to say, well, we need to get that recognized as income so we can get a certain percentage of it. And so we have to start taking money out. And the money is this is called the required beginning date, an RBD. And the required beginning date is always April 1st. It's kind of an odd. Yeah, today. Maybe that's why, Jim, you scheduled this for today. It's kind of an odd date and kind of an odd selection, but that's what we have. We're now in Secure 2.0. We passed Secure 1.0, and then we amended it not shortly after. And so we're now in Secure 2.0, and basically anyone who turns age 73 this year, they have until April 1st next year to take out their first required minimum distribution. And so that's, again, something to keep in mind, especially if you live in a state that exempts a retirement account if you're having to take required minimum distributions. As an example, if you are 66, you can't really take a required minimum distribution. You're not at the age requirement yet. So upon death, that's not even a separate session. That's a separate afternoon. It gets really complicated how we deal with these things. But we're talking about Medicaid eligibility, so we're not going to worry about how these things pay out after death. But we do want to focus a little bit on how they pay out during life, because that can affect Medicaid eligibility. So Roth retirement accounts, there are no required minimum distributions. It's another, distinct advantage, I think, of Roth retirement accounts. And as a general matter, I don't get into advising young people too often about what to do or not to do for retirement or future financial planning. But if I ever do, I definitely try to steer people to contributing more to Roth accounts, if they can afford to do it, than to traditional accounts, because I think the advantages to Roth outweigh traditional. And so one of them is you don't have to take out required minimum distributions. Now, that may, again, present a Medicaid eligibility issue. If you had a really smart Medicaid attorney, well, they say you don't have a required minimum distribution if you have a Roth. So I'm not sure I've ever heard that. I don't practice in states that do that. So, but it could be out there. And so, you know, again, the biggest advantage for a Roth is that there is no required minimum distributions during life. At death, again, it's a different story, and that's a separate afternoon. So if you have a retirement account, you know, what can you do with, where can you have it and what can you do with it? Retirement accounts can come in all shapes and sizes. And really all that a retirement account is, it's an account as you've always known in an account with a special name. You know, so I could have a retirement account. I could have the Mark Munson traditional IRA. And I could have it at my bank. I could just have it in a savings account. I could have it in a CD. I could have it in a money market fund. I can have, you know, where you see it the most is in an investment firm or a brokerage firm. You're going to meet with a client who has a traditional IRA with a financial advisor at Edward Jones, you know. So what happens there is they retire, they get done with work, and they're going to get away from their employer-sponsored plan and get into, you know, an individual retirement plan, which is the individual retirement account. That's the IRA. You do a tax-free rollover from your 401k to the IRA, which is with the Edward Jones financial advisor as an example. And then whatever Edward Jones has as available investment options, you can invest in those inside of your IRA. So be the Mark Munson IRA, the account is with Ed Jones, or the account is with Schwab, or the account is with Wells Fargo, or Fidelity, or Vanguard. You name it. Any of these financial firms do it. You can have, especially with IRAs, not so much the case with employer-sponsored plans, 401k or 403b, but especially with IRAs, you can have annuities. Annuities are financial products issued by insurance companies that provide guarantees. And they typically invest in, you know, mutual funds, stocks, and bonds, but there's an additional layer, and that additional layer is in an annuity. So you have an annuity that owns stocks and bonds, and then the annuity is owned by a retirement account, and you're kind of the owner of the retirement account. So there you have four layers: you, your retirement account, the annuity, and then the annuity invests in stocks and bonds. And again, the biggest, I think the most attractive feature to annuities to the general public is that because they are issued by an insurance company, there's going to be contractual guarantees. And, you know, you're never going to get that from a brokerage firm. They don't do guarantees. But an insurance company will do guarantees, and you pay for that. You pay for that in different ways. But that's the kind of the selling point of an annuity is there are certain contractual guarantees. And then the last type of IRA that you're going to see are self-directed IRAs and self-directed accounts. And so these are, you know, can be things, you know, in a self-directed IRA, you can own real estate. You can own gold. You could probably own, I haven't done seen it, but you probably own cryptocurrency. You can really own just about anything in an IRA that you can own not in an IRA. So you see all these, you know, more and more, I think we're going to see alternative investments, you know, and particularly real estate, maybe precious metals, gold, and then cryptocurrency is going to be out there as well.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. And again, this could take all afternoon, and we've done, actually, Mark and I have done a seminar where we took all afternoon, and we looked at all these accounts and what they look like. But Mark, when we're in a state on our map, it was an orange state or the gray state, where you have to deal with one of these accounts when you're talking about Medicaid qualification and their accountable resource. If you aren't using the Medicaid compliant annuity, which I'll talk about here in a minute, what are kind of the knee-jerk reactions to liquidating some of these accounts that are besides the annuity here? What are kind of the ramifications of doing that if maybe you're talking to an attorney that might not, you know, be a sophisticated Medicaid planner to kind of think through some alternative strategies? Kind of the simple reaction is, okay, we'll liquidate it and then we'll do crisis planning with the funds that are left over.
Right, right. And that's, you know, the challenge that's posed by retirement accounts are the taxes, right? I mean, if you think about, you know, let's just use the simple one. And, you know, you could have a savings account, right? And savings account with $200,000. And to deal with that for Medicaid, great. No problem. Right? There are no tax issues you need to think about. But if that exact same client has $20,000 in the bank, but has $180,000 inside of an IRA, and we've got to, you know, we're thinking about getting that client qualified for Medicaid. You know, well, if you're in Wisconsin, where I am, and the asset limit is only $2,000, I got to get that, you know, we got to get that IRA down. And the only way to really get it down, if it's a single person, is to take it out. And if we take it out, that is going to create income for income tax purposes. And, you know, this is the part I'll admit I don't like about the job, my job. But if we're going to do that, I do want to have a conversation with the client and the client's family about longevity and life expectancy. Because if they're going to pass away in 3 or 4 months, now we don't know that. And, you know, you have to rely on whatever is being told to the client and their family by medical professionals. But why would you want to create a $20,000 or $30,000 tax hit by liquidating the IRA if they're going to be passed away in a short period of time? So these are, you know, unfortunately, real life considerations that are out there. And if a client told me that they're, or the family told me the client's going to pass away in 3 or 4 months, you know, that's going to factor into my advice, because I don't want to create a bunch of tax for no reason. It'd be hard to get that person on Medicaid very, very quickly. And so I don't want to create the tax, because, again, this gets to a separate conversation. But, you know, then we have a larger retirement account going to the family, and we can deal with post-death distributions and taxes from there. So there's the complication with retirement accounts is that are the income taxes. And, again, with Roth retirement accounts, it's not the same. And so it's really traditional income, you know, traditional IRAs, and that's going to create income for income tax purposes. And that's really the focus. Now, if the person's has Alzheimer's or dementia, but they're physically healthy and they could live in this state for easily 5 to 10 more years, different story, then we very well may want to be looking at you know, pulling some money out so that we could, you know, if it's a single person, we could look at executing a gift and lend. It's probably my term, but I'm sure you guys use it as or have some variation. But a gift and lend type of strategy. And but with a retirement account, it's actually more of a gift and pay type of strategy, because you would take out of the retirement account what you need to facilitate the gift, leave the rest of it in there, work with Kraus Financial, turn this the whatever's remaining in the annuity, which is remaining in the retirement account, into an IRA annuity that pays out and follows the Medicaid planning rules, and then you spread out the additional income over months or years, depending on what you've got.
Greatest segue I've ever had, Mark. So let's talk a little bit about what that means, just very quickly. And again, we have a lot of resources on our website on using the Medicaid compliant annuity as an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. And just a refresher for those of you that aren't familiar with the requirements of a Medicaid compliant annuity, and these come from the federal regulations. So this isn't an annuity that you would use for any other purpose than taking that IRA and converting it into an income stream to pay through a penalty period. And again, we call that here in-house gift and annuity strategy. And again, we have lots and lots of resources on how that works. But specifically with the IRA, using this type of annuity as the chassis and then funding it with the IRA to avoid that immediate tax hit. But the basis of the annuity has to comply with the Medicaid federal statutes. And that means it has to be irrevocable, can't be revoked or altered. It has to be non-assignable, so it can't be sold to another party. It has to be actuarially sound, so the term of the annuity has to be equal to or less than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. It has to have equal payments, so no deferrals or balloon payments. And the state has to be named either as the primary beneficiary, although there are some exemptions to that. So again, a very specific tool for a very specific problem. We have too many assets, and we need to create an income stream to reduce that asset so we can qualify for Medicaid. So this is a specific strategy to avoid exactly what Mark just said, because the transfer of the IRA funds into that Medicaid compliant annuity is not a taxable event. Instead, the funds will be taxed as payments from the IRA Medicaid compliant annuity for each calendar year in which those payments are made. So if we have a longer term annuity, then those taxes will be paid as the annuity payments are paid out. So this allows the client to spread that tax liability over the term of the full annuity. Again, the annuity is limited by the client's life expectancy, but just has to be lesser than if we had a large annuity that we had to deal with. The way that this functions kind of internally is you can do either a 60-day rollover or a trustee-to-trustee transfer. The way that these monies are transfers is governed by the IRS. And so a 60-day rollover, basically what happens here is the applicant who's going to own the IRA MCA will contact the IRA custodian and says, hey, I need to liquidate this account. Don't withhold any taxes. So the client receives the check, and then they have 60 days to reinvest those funds into an IRA MCA. The client will receive a 1099-R the following year, and they just have to use the appropriate form when they're doing their taxes the next year and say, I reinvested those funds into the IRA MCA, so you don't get hit with those taxes for that year, but the tax will be paid over the lifetime of the annuity. The only difficulty with these, other than all these steps have to be followed, is that the IRS only allows one 60-day rollover every year. So another option that's a little bit more streamlined and kind of takes the client out of the equation is what's called a trustee-to-trustee transfer, where the funds from the IRA goes directly over to the insurance company that holds the annuity, the Medicaid-compliant annuity, and they obtain those funds directly. And that way it takes the client out of the mix, and those funds go directly over to the insurance company. The client, when they're applying for the MCA, does have to do some initial paperwork allowing all this to happen, but it kind of takes the client out of the equation and, you know, can be a little bit more streamlined. So go ahead, Mark.
Jump in real quick, Jim. And every time, if you want to just go back to that slide, but, you know, if I can help it and I can control it, I always want to do a trustee to trustee transfer, and that the, you know, other term you'll hear is a direct rollover. So, you know, from one traditional IRA provider to another, and you take the client out of it. And I think it's, from a tax standpoint, it's cleaner, it's easier, it's neater, and it's better. And there's just less chance for mess up. So I'm a big advocate of doing a trustee to trustee transfer or a direct rollover, as opposed to, you know, a distribution to the client, and then the client has 60 days, or the indirect rollover.
Right, right. There are some other planning strategies we want to hit on for married couples. We won't spend a lot of time because it's not a part of this particular webinar, and we want to get over to deferred annuities and how those are handled. And we do have some webinars on the name on the check rule. This is when you use a Medicaid compliant annuity to annuitize that retirement account, but you make the income payable to the community spouse. So that moves that income from the institutionalized spouse over to the community spouse. That's not available in every state. And again, if you want some more education on that, we do have that available. There are ways to move payments, and they generally require the judge to be involved. And so basically, short of divorce, you can say this IRA needs to be, this income needs to go over to the community spouse in order to maintain their lifestyle in the community, and a judge has to sign off on those. And there's a couple different options there through spousal support orders. There's qualified domestic relations orders, or quadros, and then also legal separation proceedings. Again, those generally involve getting a court involved, not as streamlined, but they can be options when you have a married couple and you want to do some planning with the IRAs. But again, those could take a whole afternoon on each one of those. But we do want to get over into the non-Medicaid compliant annuities. And when you run into those, how do you deal with those? So, Mark, we have about 15 minutes to cover this grand topic as well, and how to handle those in Medicaid. So, Mark, when you're looking at those, when a client brings in an annuity that's not a Medicaid-compliant annuity that we use for crisis planning, but more of those traditional annuities, how do you kind of look at those and assess those?
So, again, very, very similar. You know, your client's going to own one of two types of annuities. They're either going to have an annuity inside of an IRA, call that an IRA annuity, or they're going to have a non-IRA annuity. And a non-IRA annuity, I don't know if I've put it on the slide or not, but non-IRA annuities are governed by Section 72 of the Internal Revenue Code. And so, again, an annuity is a tax-deferred product. Usually, the way these things work is that a lump sum goes in, and it gets invested inside of the annuity. The insurance company is going to invest it in, you know, stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. And the earnings or the growth on that is deferred. And so, you know, you might get $200,000 inheritance, and you decide, what am I going to do with it? And you purchase an annuity, and all of a sudden this annuity is worth $300,000. Well, you have the $200,000 inheritance, which was the initial contribution. That's after-tax money. But then the next $100,000 has never been subject to its deferred income. And so you've got this deferred income problem again. So if we're trying to get down to $2,000 asset limit, or $5,000 or $3,000, you know, you've got to be thinking, okay, I've got a $100,000, you know, deferred income tax problem here, and how am I going to deal with it? So, but a deferred annuity, is, to me, I just think of it as that's an investment account without the income tax every year. And when do you get income tax? You get it when you take money out of that annuity. It's deferred in the sense that it's not annuitized. And not annuitized, if you annuitize in an annuity, you're irrevocably creating income for yourself. It's your retire, you know, and again, this is where the concept of guarantees come in. If you're going to ever contemplate, you know, annuitizing in an annuity or buying or purchasing, and I'm sure it's the next slide, an immediate annuity, which is an annuitized annuity right off the bat, you know, in Medicaid crisis planning cases, the Medicaid compliant annuity is always in an immediate annuity, always. It's never not the case. A deferred annuity is really just an annuity that hasn't been annuitized. And it's more like an investment, and you can just take money out. When you take money out, it's the last money in that's the first money out. So that income portion, when you just, you know, use my example, $200,000 is invested and now it's worth $300,000, and you say, well, I want $20,000 to get a new car. That's fine. Now the thing is worth $280,000 and you've just taken $20,000 of income. It's the last in, first out. That's the way annuities work. And so, you know, if we're going to cancel or surrender in an annuity, which Jim would say, don't ever do that. Just do a 1035 tax-free exchange. But those are the considerations that we have. Those are the considerations that we have when we're dealing with, you know, tax-deferred annuities. Deferred annuity is just more like an investment. And an immediate annuity is annuitized, and you're going to get a monthly check.
And then this slide we could take all day on.
Yeah. But, you know, if you have a client who's coming in and they have an annuity, this is worthwhile information to obtain so that you can evaluate what your client has, what that asset is all about, and make decisions. And so every case that I work on, if I see that there's an annuity, I really want this filled out so that I can understand what they have and make the best decisions possible.
Yeah, Mark, you have a form that this is, when you have an annuity, this is the basis of a form that you have your clients fill out and get that information back, correct?
Either they fill it out or sometimes, you know, we get the authorizations, and sometimes we might call the insurance company or the financial advisor and we just ask the questions and then we fill out the form. But yeah. I don't like to make decisions until I've got all this information so that we could be making an informed decision about the financial product.
Yeah, and Mark mentioned a couple options that you have for those deferred or immediate annuities. And we'll go over these again, very at a high level. And again, we do have a number of resources on Attorney Access around that. But generally, you have the option, the three options that we think of when we look at these annuities is surrender, exchange it, or sell it. And again, you need to know what type of annuity you're dealing with. Is this a deferred annuity? Is it still in that growth stage? Has it been annuitized? Is it creating guaranteed income? Is it tax funds that went in there, or is it owned by a retirement account, would allow us, if it is annuitized, to sell it for fair market value? And those are really your three options that you have available to you. So with the tax deferred annuity, can you just surrender it and say, okay, I just want to get my money back, receive the cash settlement? Unfortunately, with that option, you generally will get charged a surrender charge. And the shorter amount of time that annuity has been in place, the higher the surrender charge is going to be. So they generally start at around 15%, and then they come down the longer the annuity has been in deferred status. So not only will the client have to pay a surrender charge to liquidate that, They'll, like Mark just mentioned, they'll have to pay taxes on any interest. But then once it's liquidated, you have the cash to do your spend down strategies, do your, you know, your transfers that are non-penalized, or then do a gift and annuity strategy. And this works well with small value annuities where those surrender charges and tax payments might not be so big. And can you exchange a non-IRA tax deferred annuity into a Medicaid compliant annuity? And you can do that, and it works just like what we talked about with the IRA funds, where we're using the 1035 tax-free exchange. So we're allowing the owner to move the tax-deferred funds into a Medicaid-compliant annuity without facing those immediate tax consequences if there is a significant gain. Again, the new carrier will obtain the funds directly from the current carrier, just like what Mark mentioned with that that rollover. And it does not negate any of the surrender charges, unfortunately, but it does allow the tax burden to be spread out over the life of that Medicaid compliant annuity, and it creates income, and then we can use that income to pay through any penalty period that was made, through any gifts that were made through our strategy. And that works, you know, pretty well for high value annuities where that tax implication would create a big problem. Again, this is just kind of how it works, and we kind of talk through all of these on how you want to use that with a multi-year annuity term. Now, what Mark mentioned is those immediate annuities or those annuitized annuities, they have really limited options. You can't surrender them because the owner is only entitled to a stream of income payments. They're not allowed to get the principal of that money back, and you can't really exchange them through a 1035 exchange. We have to do there is go out into the secondary market and get what is referred to as a fair market valuation through the secondary market and see if someone's willing to purchase that. This is where you'll see the daytime jingles and all those companies out there that do the Wentworths of the world, the Peachtree's financials. They'll take these and they'll say, okay, how many payments are left on them? What is guaranteed on them? We'll give you a lump sum dollar amount, and that's a fair market value for that. And if that's done, then it's a fair market transaction, and Medicaid won't look at that as a penalized transfer because it was sold for fair market value. So the way that this works, kind of Cliff's notes of this, if you work through us and you want us to take this to see what the fair market value of an annuity that's paying an immediate, it's annuitized, is you'd send that over to us. We'll take that out, assess its value, make sure that the terms of the annuity actually allow it to be sold, and then we'll get written offers for more than one. We usually like to have three different offers on that annuity, present those written offers to the client. The client then accepts the offer, completes the necessary paperwork. The annuity transfers hands, and your client receives the lump sum. Now we can put that money into use for crisis planning. So those are available if the money is not in a retirement account, or it's not the taxes have been paid on the money. The real problem is if you have what Mark talked about earlier, if you have an IRA annuity that's been annuitized, the owners can't change on that. So you're really limited to basically just trying to plan around that guaranteed income and see if there's any way that you can play with the other income that's coming in to limit that income amount, because we know that the income that the client's getting is going to end up going to the nursing home at the end of the day. So we might want to look at, can we adjust maybe some of the other income that's coming in? Mark, anything else on those particular strategies?
Let me just share, you know, I mean, annuities are, you know, again, maybe it's just a separate webinar, Jim, that we want to put on, but annuities can be really, really, really tricky assets. So here's an example. Let's say we have a client who's in a care home, is needing or wanting to apply for Medicaid, and they have a non-IRA annuity that they annuitized 4 years ago. So, okay. So here's why annuities are exceedingly tricky assets. in Wisconsin, which is probably the state I know best for all these rules, in Wisconsin, that annuity, all at the very, very same time, would be income for purposes of Medicaid eligibility. It would be an asset for Medicaid eligibility unless and until we could get letters that prove no one will buy it. But it is an asset at the onset. And it's also a gift because annuitizing and an annuity, and if it's not a Medicaid compliant annuity, is a gift under federal law. So all 50 states would have the same rule. Now they could be more generous and not do that. But so all at the same time, you have one asset or one financial thing, this annuity, annuitized annuity. It is income, it is an asset, and it's a gift all at the same time. And that's a nightmare scenario when you're trying to get someone eligible for Medicaid. So it's not easy. These annuities are tough and just something to be aware of. You know, the deferred annuity is much, much easier because that's just going to be an asset. It's clearly it's not going to be treated as a gift. And it's not going to be income because it's deferred. It's, you know, annuitized annuities, especially if they are annuitized in the 5-year look back period, are exceedingly problematic. An annuitized annuity outside of the 5-year look back is helpful on the gift side because when you annuitized it, it was outside the 5-year look back. So you don't have any gifting issues. So, but you'd still have the income side. It's still income. And arguably, it's still an asset because it could be sold on the secondary market and you have to prove that no one will buy it. And that's, again, where Kraus Financial can really help out to provide that proof.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mark. Again, I mentioned our platform, Attorney Access. We have a free membership, and that will get you access to a good number of webinars. And we also have our premium version of that gets you access to even more CLE options, planning calculators, and expanded state Medicaid information. So feel free to click on that to start there. If you have to hop off, again, when you hop off, you'll get the survey. Fill that out, send that back to us, and we'll send out the CLE certificate information. If you want to stick around, please post your questions in there. Mark's agreed to stick around for a couple extra minutes, and we'll go through the questions. But thank you, everybody, for attending that does have to hop off. I'll throw this in there again. Mark, always a pleasure. But let's get through some of these questions. So, Mark, when you prepare a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, so now we're thinking proactive planning as opposed to the crisis planning we've been thinking about, and you have clients that have IRAs, do you just leave those assets out and have the discussion with the client that if they ever need to qualify for Medicaid down the road, what other planning could be done at that time, or how do you handle this in a proactive Medicaid planning setting where you have a client that owns an IRA? You know it could be countable down the road, but you're trying to do that pre-planning before the client's in crisis.
So, you know, pre-planning in my view is really almost more financial planning than it is legal planning. I mean, there's both, but you know, if clients are asking those questions of me, you know, I kind of want to get into, you know, what's their lifestyle and what is their fixed regular income? What do they get from Social Security? What do they get from a pension if they have one, which we're going to find as time goes on, that's going to be less and less. You know, because that income, those income streams are always going to come. There's not much as a lawyer I can do with that. So, you know, if their monthly income, you know, let's say it's a married couple and they're married in they're $4,000 a month, but they spend $7,000 a month, that's going to in my brain, I am going to say, well, I'm not going to take all their retirement assets liquidate them and put them into the irrevocable trust of which they're not a beneficiary, or at a minimum, they're an income beneficiary only, because we already know that they spend more than their fixed income. So in a case like that, I'd probably say we probably want to keep more in the retirement accounts so you can keep living the lifestyle that you want to live, because if you spend it, the nursing home's not going to get it. You've spent it. But, you know, if their income is $4,000 and they're living on $2,500 a month, you know, barring extraordinary or, you know, unusual expenses, you know, then we might have a conversation about, you know, you've got this much in your retirement account. You know, do we want to think about, even though you don't need it, do we want to take it out, create some income tax, but take the balance and get it into the trust and start that five-year clock as early as possible? So, you know, use the example of $100,000. You know, you pull out $100,000, you don't need it, you don't want it, you still got money in your retirement account, and you set aside $20,000 for taxes, and you take the $80,000 and put it into the trust. So it's really more budgeting and financial planning than legal planning, but that's how I have the conversation with the client, and I let them decide how they want to handle their money.
Yeah.
I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. We don't have any other questions, Mark. So apparently we did a good job, or we confused people so bad that everything.
Yeah, we'll probably get comments about what webinars to do next. I already have some ideas based on our slides. So
thanks so much, Mark. Mark and I, for those of you who don't know, have been teaching for years and years together, and it's always a pleasure, Mark. I love working with you.
Likewise.
And
likewise.
Thank you so much for sharing your information with everybody. Thank you, everybody, for attending. Again, you'll get an email with the survey, and it should pop up after we close out this meeting now. Thanks so much, everybody. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Krauss Financial, and thanks, everyone, for attending. Mm-hmm.